Hello, this is Ben Cesario. I'm a reporter at the New York Times, and I am the guest host this week for Popcast. We were just listening to Kerosene by Big Black, the band featuring Steve Albini, the legendary musician, producer, in quote marks, iconoclast, gadfly of rock music, who recently died at the untimely age of 61. And I am joined here by two esteemed guests to talk about his legacy. First, I'm joined by Jeremy Gordon. He's a senior editor at The Atlantic and written a lot of great pieces for The Times. And Jeremy wrote a major feature, an interview with Albini last year in The Guardian, which we're going to get to. Jeremy, thank you for being on the show.
Thanks for having me.
And next we have Joe Gross, freelance writer, longtime culture writer at the Austin American Statesman, author of the 33 and a third book on Fugazi Inn on the Killtaker. And Joe, I'm going to embarrass you. This is like personal for me since we met as college students more than 30 years ago. And right from the get-go, you were like Mr. Steve Albini. And I'm sure that you taught me a great deal of what we're going to talk about today. So, Joe, thank you for being here for journalistic and personal reasons.
Thank you, man.
This was a tough one all around, the untimely death of Steve Albini, somebody who we've seen it talked about on social media in the last day or so, just a larger-than-life presence who meant so much to so many different people. I want to wait on getting to his music. We will get to that in a minute, but I wanted to know if maybe we could start by talking about character, like his character, the character he embodied in the music world, which seems to be one of the things that people are responding to. He was the troll who had this like zealous moral compass, and eventually he apologized for his trolling. He took accountability. And I think that really resonated with people. And a lot of what you're hearing in people's responses are this like moral side of what he was all about, both in how he made music and how he comported himself. Jeremy, this was a big subject of your interview with him in The Guardian last year. Can you talk about that side of him and maybe about how that piece came about?
My editor at The Guardian had reached out to me because he had wanted to assign a profile on Steve for a very long time. He said, like, almost as soon as he joined the job a decade ago, and now he had the power to. And he was mostly inspired by, I think, this recent semi-viral Twitter thread at the time, which Steve had posted, owning up to some of his prior, you know, offensive statements. I think it had come about because someone had tried to, you know, call him out, as they say. And he just responded to it very directly and said something along the lines of, you know, I'm not hiding for anything. I'll apologize for this again. And he was very transparent about it and wasn't doubling down by saying, well, it was back in the day, or, oh, I was just talking out of the side of my mouth. He really seemed earnest and apologetic for it. And I think there's just something about the tone of the way he was talking about this. I mean, Steve was an incredibly talented writer as well. He was very articulate. He was very good at sounding out his beliefs and making it seem authentic rather than just something that somebody was saying because the moment came for him. So I was assigned to do the piece with that in mind, as I guess the surface framing, but also just given his stature in independent music and everything he'd done. I mean, he'd really done so much in his life that I think it was hard to find a particular framing that felt like, why now of all things? But that seemed to be a current that had really resonated with people, just because I think, as we know, and I'm sure many other people know, in music or in the arts, you will meet a lot of these cutting, cranky guys whose language certainly can lapse into offensiveness. I mean, I knew 1,000 guys like that when I was growing up. They're like a mainstay of the quote-unquote punk alternative spaces. And the idea, here was a guy who was the guy in that regard, who had said all these things over the years. And not only was
What are some of the things that he said?
I mean, you can, on the softer scale, were just merely provocative things like talking about, I mean, some of that, I don't even know what I can quote out loud on this podcast, but he said something about how like his band was like a way to get like the blood boiling without having to like kill animals or something. There's stuff that's just like, okay, a little extreme. And then, but just, yeah, provocative, as they say. And then there were more grosser things where he was definitely could be very denigrating to women, to female artists whose work he didn't like, which seemed to be a lot of people. He could use offensive epithets, homophobic ones or racial ones. And at the time, it was done under the guise of, I think he would claim to be like a free speech absolutist, where the word isn't as important as your intent behind it. I'm using it in a sort of satirical, ironic manner. I'm shocking you, but I'm not being offensive behind it. I'm just trying to make a point about language. Is it worse for me to say a word than it is, but not actually be a bigot versus someone who is offended by a word, but secretly hates minorities? And I think you'll see that logic from certainly a lot of people. But as time went on, talked about this with me and in public, but just seeing the number of people who really just reveled in being offensive for its own sake, combined with, I think, the sort of shifting political situation really made him rethink things. I mean, he contextualized this for me, but as I'm sure you too also remember, you know, he came of age like in the 80s, more or less, or it came of adulthood in the 80s when Reagan was president, and there were all these conversations about PC culture and language. And to him, like, the right wing ascendancy was not something to really fear, although I'm sure a lot of people would have disagreed with him at the time. But as he put it himself, as a sort of straight white man who was not a direct risk, he thought, like, these are obviously comical figures who I'm able to make fun of. Like, they're the real enemy. And so it doesn't matter if everyone should be able to see that I'm not really on their side if I'm using offensive language, because obviously I'm mocking them. And then over the last 30 years, as U.S. politics have unfolded, I think he felt very differently about that and felt very strongly about it. It was more important to signal himself as being on the side of the people who he really cared about and thought were worth being on the side of, versus trying to play with iron ear humor or claim to be exceptional, that he had some secretly more nuanced point to be made once he really got past the words.
Joe, wondering what you think about all of that. I mean, I feel like on the one hand, when he was especially would be insulting other musicians, it felt like he really meant it. Like, he was judging others very harshly for their music and their choices as musicians. But then there was also the more incendiary using racial epithets and stuff, which was it just simply joking around and for the sake of irony, or what do you think about that side of him?
I mean, I think his view of it, and this might have been in Jeremy's piece, and I apologize if I'm misremembering, that he talked about how it did not occur to him as a middle-class white guy in the 80s that these problems, the phrasing was something along the lines of, I thought these problems had been solved and we'd moved on as a culture. A, that was clearly not true. And B, he was pretty open about the idea that it was his wife who turned him around and was essentially like, look, you are misinterpreting all of these things, and here is why you are wrong, and sound kind of silly saying this stuff. The evolution thing is absolutely fascinating. I think at the very beginning of his career, when we're talking about stuff in Forced Exposure and places like that, and zine writing, where he really cut loose and established this very powerful critical persona, I think we forget how small the audience was for that sort of thing. Like, I don't think it occurred to the guy that this was going to be read by more than the audience that would know how to interpret it. And once it, and this is obviously mostly a post-Nirvana effect, once that genie was sort of out of the bottle and regular people started getting into what was once an underground thing, public perception of that guy changed a little bit. Suddenly a lot of people were like, who was this jerk? Especially after I think it was a Time magazine piece when he was working on In Utero and it hadn't come out yet. He was working on the Nirvana record In Utero. And there was a big piece in a magazine about how the label had, DGC Records, Nirvana's label, had bullied them into softening the mix of their record, which is a collection of words that makes sense to all of us. But to somebody reading a news magazine in 1992 or 1993, it was just like, who is this skinny weirdo who is complaining about the guys who had a hit with Smells Like Teen Spirit? Like, I think it's funny to contemplate how profoundly the culture, pop music culture in general, but rock music culture in particular, and underground rock music culture in particular, has changed in the 40 years since he started making music and saying goofy things in public.
That's also part of his strength, though, too, is just that, like, the voice crying in the wilderness. I think that there must have been a lot of people who had never heard of him before, never encountered him, but hearing him in the context of talking about the Nirvana record and the conformist pressures of the music industry, that there was somebody calling it out in very harsh terms. And I think that was, like, that was one of his great gifts to the world, was calling BS on the system. And he did that many times in many ways. When he died, I felt like the only other music person that I felt like this really compared to was Lou Reed, in the sense that he also died at a relatively young age. And there was a tremendous outpouring for him. And I think part of it was people saying, like, I loved how much of a jerk he was. Like, there was an honesty about that. I mean, he was a famous artist, of course, but that he was a person who, in interviews and in his public persona, there was something unfiltered, and it came across as a rebelliousness. It came across as a form of integrity to say what you want to say, even if you're being a jerk about it. Jeremy, did he still have any of that vibe in 2023?
You know, when we talked, I found him to be incredibly friendly and nice. I distinctly got a vibe from him that he was just very comfortable as himself. You know, he wasn't turning on a switch to be a little chatty just because we were doing an interview. He seemed like he did in every single interview I'd ever watched or read, or in any sort of story that was ever relayed to me by someone who knew him. He was just very comfortably himself, so to speak. And I think one of the, to speak to the point you just made, another thing about him that people really celebrated and appreciated is that Steve was very accessible as a person. His email was public. His phone number was public. He recorded bands regularly. His rates were pretty affordable. I saw so many stories floating around of just random musicians who were saying, I recorded once with him and he spent the whole day explaining to me how, like, these just how to do this work that he was doing. He really sketched out his methodology. Or I saw one testimony of someone saying they had just emailed him asking if they could pick his brain, and Steve just invited him to come by his studio, Electrical Audio, and spent the whole day demonstrating to him or this person how to just showing them the studio. And that's pretty unbelievable to consider the breadth of his resume and all of the work he had done. The idea that he felt very open, almost compelled to share what he knew with other people, not elevate himself over anyone else. And there was no sense of ego of, oh, I'm the guy who worked with Nirvana, or I was in this band in the 80s. He was very focused on the present and the now, which I think connects to everything. His so-called evolution is that he did not ever want to rest on his laurels of what he had accomplished or how people saw him. He saw his work as really being every day and in the moment.
You got this impression, and it's a little bit like Lou Reed, but it's also a little bit like your weird uncle died. That was the vibe that I was seeing in all these Facebook posts and Twitter posts and Blue Sky and stuff like that, where people were taking this man's passing extremely personally. Like people who were not particularly performative about celebrity deaths, which is, I mean, even saying that is sounds weird, applied to this guy. And maybe it's just that my feeds are full of musicians and music dorks, but it, you know, I think it was Ann Powers who said, no, I'm sorry, it was John Darnielle who said this was a generational loss. And I think that's a really good way to put it, that this was the first guy of that coterie of musicians and tastemakers and people who were involved in underground rock in the 80s and transformed it into what it was in the 90s that has died. And that goes right to the heart of the idea of being accessible, that you could just call this dude or email him and ask him something. And he considered that perfectly normal human behavior because he was a perfectly normal human guy who happened to make some of the most influential on a very specific group of people music of his scene. So it's this balance of this guy worked miracles and I have had lunch with him that really came together in this sort of outpouring of grief, because most of the, it was very much a, I remember the first time I heard Big Black, I was 15 years old and it was, I was not immune to that sort of thing. I remember exactly where I was and what I was doing the first time I heard Big Black. It was a before and after moment. And then you sort of learn more about this guy and you're like, man, he's really angry about a lot of stuff.
And that's cool, right?
Well, it's cool and it's rhetorically forceful. I mean, that's the thing about that's irritating about writing about Albini is that 9 times out of 10, he's a better writer than you, which is annoying if you're writing about music, because most of the time musicians are like pretty good. But the power of his prose was really something else. And the fact that he was very obviously light years funnier than most of his peers went a long way, I think, to establishing his cult.
I think it's good to think of him as a kind of generational icon of this person who in some ways embodied a lot of Gen X experiences and the, I don't know, the sense of ambivalence about it, that he was like Mr. Underground, post-punk, screw the system, I hate the major labels, but he did the Nirvana record at the peak of their fame. He did the Bush album. He did dip his toe into that. He took their money. And now what he's been talking about recently and what he talked about with you, Jeremy, is trying to reconcile the excesses of youth and to hold himself accountable, and like this feeling of like guilt in a way of like, we're grownups now. We did a lot of crazy stuff when we were in bands 30 years ago. What does it mean now? I mean, to me, that rang very true about just what people go through at this stage of their lives.
Yeah. And there's something that he said to me, which I put in the piece, but he very much, very clearly wanted to draw a line and say, I didn't say these things because the culture was different. He says the culture was different, but I was wrong then. He acknowledged that the people who were upset by what he said at the time were right to be upset. You know, it wasn't that they couldn't take a joke or didn't necessarily get what he was talking about. I think he very much looked at all that and said it was inexcusable and I shouldn't have done it. And being honest about that is the only way that I could talk about this ethically. He was very concerned with like ethics. And I think I got the sense he was someone who really pored over a lot of his behavior and wanted to feel right about things, or not even necessarily about feeling right, but doing the decent thing, especially in this, in his particular industry, where you're surrounded by people who are not doing the decent thing.
And it's interesting that, like, the ethics, the morals was there at the beginning. He had very bright line ideas about the right and wrong thing to do about music, but he would also say the most outrageous, reckless things for shock value. And I think he eventually turned that back on himself and thought, can I apply the same morality that I have done to this 7-inch EP from 1986 to, like, how I talk about race in America?
The open politicization of that guy, not that he wasn't, I mean, it's funny, you go back and you look at the liner notes for the live record that Big Black did that came out in like 92. And the liner notes say something like, and this was 1992. This was not recently. And the liner notes say something along the lines of, look, we're all lefties like you guys, or something like that. And you take a look at that and you're like, oh, this is, I mean, I get that. It didn't occur to me that other people didn't, that this was all him writing offensive stuff or saying stuff that was rude or obnoxious was at least in part a shtick. Like, this guy probably voted Democratic his entire life. This was not a crazy right-wing lunatic or anything like that. And then seeing him evolve into this guy that talked about politics publicly with the same sort of brutal directness and this sort of tightness and directness of argument that he would apply to thinking about how the music industry worked was really amazing. And I think there's also, you can, the, going back to the ethics thing, I talk about a little bit about this in the book, that there's this sort of key point in the American underground around 1989, 1990, 1991, where it's, there is enough attention on us that we can form an alternative economy to major labels. Labels like Touch and Go, Discord, Merge, places like that. We can form this thing that exists outside of the major label system and make money doing it because we have a music that people want. Or we can sign with a major label and try and find a new audience because our bands are the best band. And those were the two sort of dominant theories of how to approach success. And when bands with a great deal of potential for a wider audience started going to majors, the 21st century doesn't really talk about selling out much. It is hard to explain to people under 30 the extent to which the idea of selling out was a primary motivator for the way people conducted themselves during a certain period of time.
And the anxiety about that choice.
And the anxiety surrounding that, yeah. And that's, it's just, it's one of those things that's difficult to explain to people who were not there at the time. And that there was a right way and a wrong way to get, try to get rich and famous. And openly trying to get rich and famous was not considered cool. Whereas openly trying to get rich and famous seems to be just fine now.
I'm Julie Turkowitz. I'm a reporter at the New York Times. I have been trying to understand changes in migration. So I traveled with photographer Federico Rios to the Darien Gap, this hot, mountainous, 70-mile stretch of jungle straddling the border of Colombia and Panama.
We're hiking through a river, just like covered in mud.
Many used to think that this route was impassable, but thousands have been risking their lives to pass through the Darien, almost all in the hopes of making it to the United States. We spent 9 days hiking through the gap and weeks building trust and relationships with migrants, with smugglers, with migration authorities to even be able to do this reporting. We interviewed hundreds of people who have made this journey to try and grasp what's making them go to these lengths to find a new life. New York Times journalists spend time in these places to help you understand what's really happening there. You can support this kind of journalism by subscribing to the New York Times.
I want to shift gears and talk about like the musical legacy of Steve Albini here. And I want to start with the word producer. This is one of the strange ticks about him that if you've read anything about this man, you've probably encountered this, that he preferred to call himself an engineer, a recording engineer who recorded bands as they played. And he did not like to use the term producer. And again, he had ethical ideas for that. I think he often said that implied a level of control over the artist's work that he did not want to impose. And then there was also the sort of music industry accounting side of it, where producers usually took so-called points, meaning extra royalties, which he thought was unfair. I gotta say, I have always felt that this was a little disingenuous, not the points side of it, which I think is very righteous, but him insisting that he was not a producer, I never quite bought it. And I didn't really ever understand why it was such a big deal to him, because it always seemed that he was doing much more than a simple engineer, which is a basic technical function. And he did have a sound, he did have a style, and that's artists came to him for that reason. And, or at least that was one of the reasons they came to him. And it was partly defined by things like the drums. He had an incredible drum sound, the way he treated guitars. He had these strange tics about the way he recorded things like vocals. Joe, I'd like to start with you about your thoughts on this. I'm sure you could talk for hours, but in a nutshell, like, what do you think about this part of his sort of biography of his obsession with that word and why it was a problem for him?
I agree with you to a point about the disingenuousness, but I also absolutely understand why that was part of his whole deal. Is the idea was that the way he would record a band was to set up mics, get the best sound, get the most natural sound of the band, hit record, and then play, as many people have commented, play video poker during your session. Like, that's the stereotype. And I think that does a couple of things. It removes him from the idea that he is facilitating this band's bad taste. Like, if this band is bad, he is not the reason it is bad. Which I think was both very smart and a little bit of a cop-out in sort of two directions. That, yeah, maybe recording a band naked in a room isn't the best way to make a record for particular bands. But when it worked well, you got some of the greatest rock records of the past 30 years. I think somebody in Rolling Stone recently said that one of the things that's amazing about the Jesus Lizard, he recorded 4 records and an EP with them, is that they were a band almost designed to sound great based on the way he made records. And that guitar, bass, drums, 3 spectacular musicians, and a crazy man on vocals just holding a mic is the sort of the ideal stereotypical Albini thing. And
very like tight rhythm, screechy guitars.
Yes.
It was perfect for his style, sure.
Yeah, he emphasized drums and guitar and de-emphasized bass and voice. Like, that was pretty consistent in his recordings. And frankly, some bands, and you're right about him having a sonic signature, like especially when he started using the Electrical Audio Studio, his studio in Chicago, when that was built and bands started recording there rather than the studio that was in his house in Evanston, you can hear that room in about 15 seconds on a record that he made. You can hear the sound of that room. And so there's definitely fingerprints on stuff that he recorded. So if you're saying, I'm not producing this, saying I'm not producing this is just as much of a stance as saying I am producing this on some level. It's just not the production of, yeah, that beat is terrible. We're going to rewrite this and I'm going to take a third of your songwriting credit doing it. But countless bands who recorded with him said he was open and had suggestions if we wanted them and didn't give them if we didn't want them, and really did see his job as, I want to execute your vision. The flip side of which is, you better have your vision down real well before you get in the studio, or the record's not going to be terribly interesting.
I will say that one of the things that always amazed me about how he recorded is that even though he had this technique and a style that worked perfectly for aggressive, tough Jesus Lizard, Nirvana rock bands, the very same techniques when he was doing, say, the Breeders or Low or a Palace Brothers record, something could have just this crystalline intimacy about it. It was amazing how those records, which didn't have any of that same kick you in your gut aggro stuff, there was still something about the Steve Albini sound that worked perfectly for that, for a completely different kind of music. And I always really admired that about him.
It's too bad that he wasn't a big jazz guy, because I would have been fascinated to hear him record a small jazz combo or a big band. Like, what would an Albini recording of a trumpet quartet, a trumpet-led jazz quartet sound like? It's an interesting thing. It's an interesting thing to contemplate.
Jeremy, what do you think about Albini, the producer who was not a producer?
I think about his precision in using language and the way he thought about things. And to me, it's almost a semantic difference where, regardless of how much work he was doing with the band's sound or his impact on it, he was not producing them in the sense of shaping like anything about their vision or the way that they sounded or the way that they approached things. I assume you two have seen the Metallica documentary, Some Kind of Monster, but the record that they were making with Bob Rock, you know, he's very much a member of the band. He's almost like he may as well just be a member of Metallica, in as much as how much he is contributing to the creative process. To me, it's like almost the difference between like a photographer who stages scenes in front of him and then shoots versus a photographer who's just shooting what is in front of him in the most ideal conditions possible. Albini, to me, was the latter. He did not like to do much overdubbing. He did not do, he preferred to record to analog versus digital. So it really had to be gotten, the take had to be good or as close to as good as possible, because it's just a lot more work to go back and stitch things up if it's not good. He wanted to capture bands like as they were, the most ideal state of the way that they thought that they were, versus we'll just fix it in post, or you did one good decent take of a vocal of a couple lines in a verse, but we can stitch that together with this other take of this chorus. And so it's a philosophical stance almost, the idea that he really believed in the power of like rock music. I mean, that's corny to say, but I mean, like literally the sensation, the feeling you got of going to a show and seeing a band that was really tight and loud in front of you. This is something he talked about many times, of just, there was a power in that. And I think that's that idea of seeing a band live and really that registering with you was something that he wanted to recreate in the studio, versus the sense of we labored over this for so long in order to get it just right.
To some extent, a lot of it was a reaction and an opposition to standard operating procedure in the music industry, that the producer, in a lot of cases, especially the major label, the band going from the indie label to the big label, there would be a control, there would be a compromise, there would be a producer that would be paid a lot of money, that would possibly like exploit the insecurities of the band. There was a label that was pushing for a radio hit. That was, to the point Joe was making a moment ago, like that was like on the other side of the hill that every band of that time was worried about, was if we are good now, if we sign to the major, are we going to get screwed up? will our goodness be corrupted? And I think that he was a sort of alternative path there to say, like, just play. I will capture you. I guess it'll sound like my drum sound and whatever, but like, I will capture you was what he was offering them.
He told me a story about hearing a story from Ian MacKay at the start of his recording career when he was playing with his band, the Teen Idols. And then about it was a story about how the producer that they were working with was just tremendously rude and dismissive of the band in the studio to the point of almost like not wanting them. You know, like, why are you guys even playing here? This is terrible. And Steve's story was just that how terrible of a feeling he met that must have been for the band. Here you are, or any band really, like you come in with all of your ideas, you think you've been practicing, and here's this know-it-all who's just going to come and tell you, well, that doesn't sound good, or I wouldn't do that. I mean, it's such a vulnerable thing to record any sort of creative practice, to come to lay down what you have in your mind and hope that someone will take it seriously. And your hope is that it's going to be judged by the public, not before it gets out of the room. And so, that was the other sort of duality of both his ability to be offensive and rude about other people, and then this tremendous amount of respect he had for everyone who came into the studio, even though plenty of people have stories about him making little jokes, but it was all, I prefer to think it's all done. I mean, it was done in good humor rather than just, I'm this guy who knows better than you. I have superior taste. I mean, he said something to me about how his own taste was perverse and it would be and not a good thing to enforce that on other people. So he really tried not to, unless of course he was asked, but the difference between being asked for your opinion versus just having that attitude of like, I'm the guy.
The thing that's interesting and paradoxical about that is the extent to which people got in the habit, rock fans got in the habit of buying records that he recorded just because he recorded them, which is exactly what you would imagine he did not want to happen. But people did it anyway. And I think it's, I was thinking about this yesterday, and he's one of the very first examples of, in his production style and in his production philosophy, of retweets do not equal endorsements. Like, he's going to record your band for $700 an hour or whatever it was, but he is not responsible for you being bad. Like, if the songs are lousy, he will record their lousiness beautifully. But it's not necessarily going to help you make him less lousy unless you say something. And so there was this weird balance where, I mean, for a brief period of time, that was true because he was in the habit of recording his friends and helping bands that he genuinely liked make good recordings. But there was also a point where, hey, we're going to, near the end, what is now difficult to contemplate as the end of his career, you'd find a lot of underground rock records that were not particularly good that were recorded by him. And it's like, well, this sounds great, but this is not a terribly interesting record. And it's nobody's fault except the band.
To follow up on Jeremy's comment a moment ago, one of my favorite comments that was posted on social media was by the band, I guess we'll call them Effed Up. And it says, RIP Steve, you hated our band and made fun of us while we were recording at your studio, but you stood up for something honest and fair in music and tried to make it a better place in everything you did, and there will never be another one like you. It's just incredible. I mean, I was like, where's the punchline of, I hate you, man? But that was like, that's Steve Albini in a nutshell, I think, is that like, he was the troll who could piss people off and would make fun of the bands like practically to their face, but they admired him. He stood for something, and very few other people that they would come across did.
Yeah, it's interesting that when he started recording bands and started coming out of that scene in the 80s, that was the lingua franca of that scene, was that people will give each other an enormous amount of grief, but we're all still friends, or at least we've got to play on the same bills. And so, but as the community gets bigger and you start recording, and he starts recording bands that aren't necessarily part of his inner circle, that sort of attitude suddenly seems downright exotic. that strikes me as being treated like one of the guys, as it were. But at the same time, he was very open about saying, my taste is not relevant to recording a band, which, yes and no. It's, you know, I don't necessarily think that's the blanket statement it sounds like, but you can see where he's coming from. That is a sentence that says, I'm if you show up, I will do a good job for you, as he was fond of saying, like a plumber. Like, I will do the job that I am assigned. I'm not saying I'm not going to tell you that you are lousy while I'm doing it, if I know that you can take the joke. Does that make sense?
Yeah. He told me a story about how in the late 90s, he was approached by Robert Plant and Jimmy Page of Led Zeppelin to record their record. They were making music together for the first time in however many years, which is, as you can imagine, was a level of celebrity and visibility that was much different than anyone he'd really worked with, even Nirvana. And he said something about how working with them was the first time that he thought to himself that he had not been hired just for his reputation alone. He was hired to do a job. And if he didn't do the job, they were going to be happy firing him and bringing in the next guy who was going to do it how they wanted. And this was described to me in the context of this softening of his ego and understanding he didn't want to weigh in on everything. And I think by that point, he had already kind of stepped away from the more opinion-driven production. But it was that sense of seeing himself as just a cog in the process rather than, yeah, someone who was going to really have some fundamental role in making it good or bad. But I always thought that was such a contrast to so many of the described experiences. I mean, working with these two global celebrities. I mean, he said something about how they had broken for the weekend. And when they came back on Monday, Robert Plant was like, oh, I was in Monaco. I went to Monaco for 2 days or whatever. Like, what'd you do? And well, wasn't flying to Monaco to come back to London. So that, I mean, I got the impression that made a big imprint, that experience.
The Page and Plant thing, I think, is an interesting example because it's an example of somebody working with some guys that invented him in a certain way. It is impossible to imagine Steve Albini's drums without When the Levee Breaks.
He talked about Bonham a lot, right?
I'm sure he did. Yes. I mean, that is the sound that, you know, that the first time you hear Surfer Rosa, if you're a kid and you've heard Led Zeppelin records before, you pick that record up and you're like, oh, this sounds like Zeppelin. Like, this sounds like, this is the drum sound of When the Levee Breaks. And that was certainly my experience. And you flip it over, you know, look at the credits, and it's like, who the hell is Steve Albini? But, you know, this is a sound that I think is absolutely amazing. And so working with Page and Plant was like, oh, this guy, in working with Jimmy Page, he is working with a producer who is absolutely as good as he is. And I think he would probably say much, much better. You listen to those Zeppelin records and they sound uniformly incredible. You like the song or you don't, but they sound amazing. And it's impossible to imagine his production style on something like the Jesus Lizard without the existence of Led Zeppelin. So producing that record, I always thought was a fascinating, like, oh, this is a bit of a weird full circle moment, isn't it?
The key to the whole story of Steve Albini is Nirvana, and that if he had simply recorded the Jesus Lizard records and Surfer Rosa and maybe even PJ Harvey and all of the great music that he did, we would be remembering him as a really good producer, engineer of underground music. But the fact that there was this bizarre moment in the early 90s where, like, the Jesus Lizard and Nirvana were kind of on the same plane for a second. I mean, they literally made a single together where, like, the band that kicked Michael Jackson off of number one on the charts came from a crazy underground grunge rock milieu, and that this was an intersection of the underground and mainstream pop culture. And it's so fascinating to look back on it now and see that it was an incredible like opportunity for him, a big moment, an important record, but it was also very fraught. Like, you know, he writes the letter to them saying like, I'll do it under these conditions and it's got to be good and it can't be just some BS nonsense and I'm not going to be paid like a producer. And then in the aftermath, they're giving the tapes to other people to remix. It has all of that fallout to it of the sort of bad taste that's left into people's mouths after they go from the underground to the mainstream. And that whole experience, I think, is like the key moment in the story of Steve Albini. He might bite my head off if he were to hear me say that. But I think if you're writing his biography, if you're writing his obituary, that's the signal moment.
I think this is something he talked about in his Baffler essay, The Problem with Music, or it might have been some other interview clip that I saw, but he talked about the pitfalls of thinking that you can be the one to outsmart the system. You know, if I get this deal, I can get a manager, I can work things to my advantage, and I can somehow avoid the mistakes that other people have made. When in reality, they're not necessarily mistakes. They are things, you know, they're not to be paranoid, but they're forces conspiring against you to not make things go the way that you want. Joe mentioned this Time Magazine article where all of a sudden you have like, record label executives giving anonymous quotes to Time Magazine about how Albini is screwing up this band. Now, that's not something that quote unquote decent people want to deal with in their dealings, but sometimes you have to go through it. And the Nirvana experience gave him all this exposure, but you know, he talked about how it made him toxic to a lot of entities about in terms of major labels didn't want to work with major label executives didn't want their bands to work with him anymore. I remember talking to Gavin Rossdale of Bush for this Guardian piece, who Albini made a record with. And he was saying that like Jimmy Iovine was like really pushing him against working with Albini when they wanted to do it, but they stuck to it and made it work. And it's easy to see Albini as this sort of towering figure, which he was in his community. But then you compare that to some of the forces that you can imagine exist at these companies or within the industry who just have so much more clout and money and institutional reach and the ability that they may have had to affect him. And it's easier just to see it as like he's really standing up for some authentic principles. This was someone who was, if he thought of himself as a cog on a record, he was just a cog in this broader tapestry of bands and people involved with them. So I don't know where my point is with that, but just that it's hard to like stick up for what you believe in when you, I mean, not just, it's hard and difficult in general, but especially when there's really people working against you to disadvantage you for that.
I think that's absolutely true. And I think it's also the question of Nirvana is a thorny one, because unless that band was prepared to make Nevermind Part 2, whoever had to record that thing, the follow-up, was going to be under ungodly amounts of pressure from different areas, from both sides. But you've got guys at Geffen saying, old school record guys who had no idea what the logic was of a band that kind of didn't want to be famous this fast, versus an underground that was saying, oh, you guys are sellouts for not only signing to a major and making a record that sounded like a beer ad, but having a hit single out of it, multiple hit singles. And so you've got this situation where there's this poor guy who I think wanted to sign to a major and like get his finances in order and be Sonic Youth, have a certain amount of success, make this band a viable full-time option. And then 4 or 5 months later, he's suddenly being called the voice of a generation. And he's probably just turned old enough to rent a car. And it's just astonishing to think about 30 years later, how fast this was. And if you were a kid then, it was like, oh, this is how rock music works. Like you sign to a label and then your stuff is pretty good and you get famous. And when the thing about picking Albini to record the follow-up was a very direct, we are not part of this machine that we have been thrust into. We are signaling that we want to do something that is rougher and less flagrantly commercial, which we didn't know was flagrantly commercial at the time, because records that sounded like us hadn't been a thing yet.
It was a protest.
It was a protest. And it was not as self-conscious, I think, as let's see if we can buy some of our credibility back. I don't think it was that. I think it was genuinely, I want to hear what our records sound like with this guy producing them. I mean, according to legend.
I disagree with you. I think it was an attempt to reclaim credibility. And I think it was, did we do something bad? Let's go back. Let's get back to something more aggressive and underground sounding. Like, we're not Michael Jackson. I do feel like it was a correction. Yeah.
That's a fair point. And famously, Nirvana sent a demo to Touch and Go at some point, and Touch and Go was not, Touch and Go is the label, for people who have no idea what I'm talking about, Touch and Go is the record label that Albini's bands put records out on. Oh, a lot of sense.
One of the ultimate indie punk 80s labels from Chicago.
It's easy to forget this now that time has passed, but I think also there was an element to the dynamic where someone like Cobain really looked up to someone like Albini. I mean, Albini was just a few years earlier, older than him. Well, we're talking the difference between like 30 and 26, which is nothing. But by that point, Albini had been a public figure, so to speak, for what, almost a decade, especially if you were someone who paid attention to punk music as much as Kurt did and collected zines and went to shows. I mean, he had seen Big Black perform. He had paid attention, probably subscribed to every zine that he ever wrote a column in. And I think it wasn't just the idea of I'm going to reclaim some credibility, but almost working with the hero, especially at this moment of, I mean, hero is such a grandiose word for how Albini carried himself. But yeah, if you're sort of navigating these feelings of authenticity and credibility as the machine is trying to take you over, you're not just working with a guy who stands for these things, but who is the person whose work in particular you have looked to as a guiding point. And I think Steve Albini was very aware of that and then just wanted to help them out. I mean, I think I don't want to speak for him, but I recall him talking about this and with me just in the context of seeing that this is a band that was very easily going to be taken advantage of, and not in the sense that they didn't have their wits about them, but there was just so much. I mean, they were the golden goose of the time. There's so much outside influence that could have changed the sound of the record and did, in fact, do that. And it was almost like an act of solidarity to just be like, I know you are from this world that I respect and I trust your values, and I'm going to almost like do you a solid and by helping you make this.
Okay, so in our time left, I want to talk about Albini's own music and his bands, primarily Big Black and Shellac. I'm curious what you guys think about that legacy. And I also want to point out something that Joe reminded me of, which is that Shellac, which has been his main band since the early 90s, is about to release their latest album, their first album in 10 years. It's just about to come out. Shocking timing to that. I don't know if you guys have heard it. I haven't heard it yet. But maybe I should start with you, Joe, since you're such the Albini scholar. I personally have never like been the biggest fan. I admire it and some of the music I like a lot. But I do wonder at this point in time, how do you think like the Big Black legacy holds up in 2024?
Well, that's a big question. It mixed. In that it is very much music of a particular time and place. But I think the way those songs are put together and the way they sound can still be profoundly powerful to somebody hearing them for the first time. And it's, you put those records on now, and the way that he uses the way that band used a drum machine was so influential in the American Underground at the time that like other bands woke up and were like, maybe we should try and use a drum machine. And those records, some of them sound absolutely extraordinary. I think witnessing them live, which I am too young to have done, was a very profound experience. There's a wonderful interview on the podcast Creative Control from 2015 with Ian MacKay and Steve Albini, who are very similar people in a lot of ways and flip sides of each other in some interesting ways, but very similar in a lot of ways, where they talk about, Ian talks about seeing Big Black for the first time. And Ian says something like, my thing is heartbeats. Like, I'm interested in natural rhythms, like the beat of a heart. I think that's my center. Big Black is the opposite of that, is this just wall of sound coming at you, extremely loud, extremely distorted. I mean, I think, I don't know what contemporary listeners would make of those records, because it's very hard for me not to hear innovations in the way simply guitars sound in most underground rock bands of that type that came afterwards. I think that the musical legacy is that he put together with that band, it's definitely one of those things that if you were into it, you were extremely into it. And if you weren't into it, it was like, I don't understand why you are interested in this at all.
I think it's like the aesthetic is all about extremity. It's all about really extreme sounds and noise. And that never dates well. Like, what was extreme 30 or 40 years ago doesn't sound extreme anymore. So the sound of the guitars, the sound of the drum machine is less shocking. But I felt listening to it now that it, especially in his voice, just the feeling of like rage and just the voice screaming at the insanity of the world just comes across so powerfully. And to me, like when you first start to hear the drum machine, it does sound like Ministry or something. Like it doesn't sound as wild as I remembered it, but the songwriting and the voice were the thing that really jumped out to me listening to it again. And that felt as wild as ever. Jeremy, what's your take?
Yeah, so it's funny. When I was beginning to draft this story after I had met Albini, I picked up a copy of Atomizer on vinyl. My wife and I have a record player in our kitchen, and typically we'll just put on some music as one of us cooks. And my wife is, this sounds silly to say, someone's a huge music fan, but she listens to quite a lot of music and knows more than me, probably. And she had never heard Big Black before. And she said something about how like she was expecting something totally different. She thought that they were supposed to be more like Ministry or industrial, but she was really taken by just how like taut and aggressive and like pitched it was, and how like interesting and noisy and aggressive. Like it still sounded for the first time, like hearing it in her life. And when I think about revisiting like the Big Black records or Shellac, like the extremity sticks out to me about some of those records. But what also really resonates, and I think this is the thing that immediately just still leaps out, you're hearing for the first time, is just how attentive they sound. I mean, these don't sound like records made by people who are staring at their pedals and taking their time, which is to say nothing of music that's a little bit more relaxed. But Big Black and Shellac, it sounds like music being played by people who are like standing on their tiptoes, like we're just like ready for like anything to happen. Like there's just a sense of awareness and like intentionality. I mean, Shellac in particular being so stripped down. I mean, it's just the fundamental instruments, as Joe, I think you said earlier, it's like guitar, drums, bass. Like it's as like basic as it could get. And part of the project, as Steve said to me, is just like maximizing what you can do with that, with as little as possible. And so that's what I think of when I think about those records. It's just like the because it's everything sounding the way that it's meant to, and it's very aware of where it is, and there's no messing about, there's no kind of noodling as you were. It is like almost like a concentrated rock music, and it's like platonic ideal form of just like, here's no nonsense.
I agree. I think there's something that's interesting about the music that he made over this 40-year span is I like to think of it as like, started going from Big Black to Shellac. I like to think of it as one of those magic eye posters where like one black shape, and then if you adjust your eyes, you see this white shape. That's the arc of his career in terms of the sound of the music itself. You have Big Black, which is this incredibly dense thing, to this dense wall of sound that has breaks and room for space, but it's mostly characterized by this relentlessness. Like you turn on the drum machine and then go. And then 3 minutes later, you get another like blast of this furious thing. And then with the Rape Man record, which is an extraordinary record hampered by one of the worst band names of all time. And that record holds up to this day. It's an extraordinary album. Terrible band name, that you have this sort of trying to figure out, okay, we take away one guitar and now we have a live drummer and it's a classic power trio. What does that sound like? And you have these extraordinary songs with them. And then by the time you get to Shellac, the percentage of noise and silence has been reversed, that you've got these songs that deal with space in a really interesting way. There's a lot of, it's almost like an on-off switch, like here is music, here is space. And those Shellac music makes a great deal more hay out of silence and space than something like Big Black, which is just a big rush at you. And I mean, when Shellac started, they described themselves very openly as a minimalist rock trio. And I think, well, you know, what Jeremy said is spot on, that it's like, we are going to be a minimalist rock trio. What does that mean? What does it mean to use these things to make a record? We're not going to introduce weird errant pedals. I mean, I haven't heard the new record, and maybe there's a weird errant pedal on there, but I would seriously doubt it.
Jeremy, I had a question for you. When you talk to Albini about his whole reconciliation period, so much of that was about his like extra musical commentary, things he said, things he wrote. Did he feel like there was anything in his music, like Big Black lyrics and stuff, to apologize for? Was that at all part of his process?
I don't think the music itself, but maybe like the artwork that they had used for a single, or like liner notes that he had written. We didn't get too much into the nitty gritty of actual songs. I believe he would have held this distinction of art and the artist, in the sense of like Big Black's music was not autobiographical. They were describing extreme situations. I think he was a little bit more, like, for example, he talked directly about regretting naming the band Rape Man, but he didn't talk about like regretting the music itself or using single art for a Big Black single called Il Duce. Writing in the liner notes about how much they admired Benito Mussolini. Like, that's the type of thing he felt bad about, but not the song itself, in my recollection.
That's interesting, right? That, like, in terms of making music, there was nothing that he felt he needed to address, apologize for, anything like that.
It's like the stuff around the music, whether what you call your band or what the artwork you use or the way that you present it in the liner notes, all of the extracurricular stuff.
Are there any sort of concluding thoughts here that you guys might want to share about the legacy of Steve Albini, or the response over the last day? What do you guys think? Jeremy, you want to say anything there?
When I first talked to him and was taking in just what, I mean, we had talked for a long time, and it's so many things that ultimately did not make it into my profile. But what I was really struck by was just the way that he talked about making music or being creative or doing anything, is it was not some expression of a celebrity or a means of getting famous. Like, he talked about, it's funny because he was such an unpretentious figure, but he was very open talking about art and artistry and being an artist and what that meant to work at something every day and what it meant to make music or any sort of creative act. Yeah, not because it was going to make you a big deal, but because it was important to do it because it made your, like, it made you better. I mean, I don't think he put it in those terms, but think about the purpose of being alive in your everyday existence and what any sort of hobby or skill or trade that anyone ever picks up, like, renewal and joy and purpose in, like, the everyday act and the small acts of creation is, as just like philosophy for how to, yeah, get the most out of your time here. I mean, it even extends to the fact that he had a home garden that he cooked, he pulled herbs from and vegetables and cooked for his wife and his friends all the time. The idea of you do it in your circle, you do these things because they are, maybe as a tech person would say, you're not optimizing your time the best. You learn something from the practice of doing it. It's the process, not the rewards. And again, here's someone who had done so much, and I mean, more than any profile or interview or podcast could ever sum up. And he did not look back. He was not nostalgic whatsoever. He was not like saying, oh, this time that I did this great thing. It was all very much in the moment and going forward. And I was just thinking about that as it related to whatever sort of creative practice I've ever wanted to do, or if people I know in my life. And just, you think of, what is the purpose of doing this thing? Where is it getting me? And well, the purpose is doing the thing. It's not about where it's going to get you or where you might go. You go somewhere in the act of doing it. I got this feeling that I was like talking to some sort of Buddhist scholar, even though, yeah, he was not necessarily a Zen figure, but he had this, to me, it just felt like a very profound outlook on life, even though it was quite simple in terms of its decency or attempt to just like do right by the people around him and live in the moment. So the music is fantastic, I think, and this is my just impression from having talked to him, but that really stuck with me. And I think it's something that many people in his life and around him picked up on and have relayed similarly.
Joe Gross, what do you say?
I think all of that is absolutely spot on. I think he is a figure that could have only, I think he really took the idea of what, he's a wonderful example of what happens when somebody takes punk rock real seriously and says, well, what does this mean to think of this, to think of the world in a particular way, that there is a correct way to do things. And it just so happens that the correct way to do things also screws over the least amount of people possible. And you can make great art without participating in the nonsense that can come around making great art. And yeah, he just seems like a guy that was this interesting combination of profoundly down to earth and colossally smart and a very precise thinker. And all of that came together in a way that made him, somebody else used this phrase the other day, and it's horrifying to think about in terms of this guy, but somebody referred to him as a particular kind of public intellectual. And you wouldn't want to say that about your worst enemy, but that's an amazing idea regarding him, because his ideas were always freely available if you knew where to look. And he was always very willing to give you his opinion on something when asked, and had grown out of the habit of giving it to you whether requested or not. But the overwhelming feeling that I think was generated by his passing was, I have lost someone I feel very personally about, in a way that I have not lost someone I feel very personally about who was also this famous before. That was a terrible sentence. But yeah, I just approaching your work with integrity and directness, approaching the world with integrity and directness, will get you pretty far.
I mean, I love the thought that the guy who made some of the most like horrendously ugly sounds and took these outrageous stances on so many things, partly just out of provocation, that like his ultimate legacy is about ideas and about the moral teachings that you can take from punk rock music. That's the origin of so much of what he talked about. And I think what he ultimately came around to in his life. And I think that's a kind of an amazing journey that he went on, and that like that is his legacy in a big way.
Yeah. You can make colossally ugly art with a generosity of spirit that really resonates with people over the long term.
Okay. I want to say thank you to Jeremy Gordon and Joe Gross for joining us here to talk about Steve Albini. Thank you guys very, very much. Go in peace with big black guitars.
Thanks, Ben.
Thanks.
Every podcast ever is available at nytimes.com/podcast. Every episode of Podcast Deluxe with John Caramonica and Joe Coscarelli is on YouTube at youtube.com/podcast. Please like and subscribe on Apple, Spotify, YouTube, or anywhere you get your audio content. Our producer, as always, is Pedro Rosado from Headstepper Media. We will be back next week. Let's go out with the song Prayer to God by Shellac. Not the first.